Welcome to Manifold. My guest today is Casey Hanmer, the CEO and founder of Terraform Industries.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, welcome, Casey. I invited Casey because of some very high recommendations I received from some very serious technologists about what he does. At the time, I knew nothing about him, so I went home and looked him up, and he's doing incredible stuff and has a fascinating background. So I'm very happy to have him on the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great. So I'd like to talk, before we get into the bulk of the matter, which is Terraform Industries and our energy future and our carbon future, which I think you have a lot to say about. I'd just like to talk to you about your early life. You're from Australia, and I think you went to Caltech for your PhD. Is that correct?
Yes. That's all correct. I was born in Australia in the late 1980s, which I guess makes me one of this kind of dying breed of millennials that has actually experienced how computers work. And then at 23, I immigrated to the United States to pursue academia.
Now, when you first came to Caltech, were you thinking that your ultimate path would be in academia? Like, what was your idea when you started graduate school?
Yeah, so I applied to 6 grad schools in the United States. I did not apply to any safety schools. I really didn't manage my process there very well. I didn't have any close friends or relatives who'd really gone through the academic process, so I just kind of YOLO'd it. I was admitted to 2 of them. I was admitted at Berkeley and at Caltech, and in 2010, Berkeley was in the throes of some fairly serious financial problems, and I thought, well, it would be a real shame to move halfway across the world and then spend 4 years wasting time because you can't get funding to do basic stuff. As it happened, I ended up working in a pretty low-cost theoretical corner of physics, but it was by no means guaranteed at the time. So I said, well, you know, I'm not going to change hemispheres to, you know, screw around. So I went to Caltech instead, which I thought was kind of the grad students I met there were much more focused on, I don't know, just like doing just the work, working really hard. And that's what I wanted. So it was good to have the choice. I don't regret going to Caltech.
You know, I was an undergrad at Caltech and I did my PhD at Berkeley. So I know both.
Oh, there you go.
Well, actually.
Well, the best of both worlds. Best of both worlds. You know, I spent more time with undergrads than grad students really at Caltech because I was quite heavily involved in student clubs and they're mostly undergrad run. Yeah. And it's an incredible program. It's really, it may come back, but I think the Caltech Common Core program is one of the few schools that really offers this like deeply rigorous background in all of science. And I know it's not for everyone and I know it's challenging for everyone, but I think it's also, you know, at a certain point, if you desperately need to become fluent in as much of a basic scientific knowledge as possible, you just have to go hardcore. There's no better time in your life to do it when you're young and still have time in your hands.
Right. And you sort of did it another way because I think you have like, didn't you triple major as an undergraduate? I think I saw that on your CV.
Yeah. Yeah. I went to Sydney University, which is not super well known outside of Australia, but it's actually a pretty good school. It's obviously quite comprehensive. It's about 50,000 students, but they're, physics department in particular is quite highly rated, and I was very fortunate to have some really good mentors there. Shout out to Professor Martin Destoke and a few other people there who know who they are. Yeah, and so it's kind of an interesting thing actually. Like At Caltech, I ended up teaching a lot of physics as well, and I would say that essentially all these classes are taught from the same textbooks. They follow the same material. At Caltech, maybe the students are maybe one standard deviation more academically selective or something like that, but the actual rigor of the classes at the advanced grad level is pretty much the same, with the exception of maybe a handful of seminars. And so I was basically just got my list of courses to choose from and ticked every box and then ground my way through them in 4 years and, actually mostly in 3 years. And I don't regret doing it. It's kind of one of those funny things. Like if you want something done, you'd best give it to a busy person. And, I was very, very busy. So I was able to get a lot of stuff done.
Yeah. I sort of got that sense from looking at your track record. As an undergrad, I think your research was in optics and somehow you ended up doing computational general relativity. So was that an accident or was that something you knew you wanted to do when you went to Caltech?
Yeah, I mean, gravity was always on my bucket list, academically speaking, and there wasn't the right kinds of opportunities at Sydney to work on that for me, I think. And that's mostly a reflection on my academic immaturity then and probably now as well. But I think the underrated thing, both for undergraduate research and grad student research, is you have to work on something that you're at least interested in, but you absolutely have to have an advisor that you gel well with. And that was, you know, a matching problem. And I really, you know, now I'm a manager. I can like say, holy shit, like how did me at 20 or 19 or something ever manage to find any adult who could put up with me? So again, credit the people who did. But yeah, I was really, really fortunate to fall in with the optics group at Sydney University, which then, and even now I believe was doing really, really cutting edge stuff. The kind of technology spin-offs that were to come from that maybe didn't go quite as far or weren't quite as exciting as was hoped at the time, but it also gave me an incredible foundation for just knowing how to analyze really complex problems and solve them. And I mean, I still apply the fundamental physics I learned there almost every week nowadays, because optics is everywhere. You know, it's really hard to escape from it.
Yeah. And I think your timing was really good at Caltech, because the work you did in computational general relativity was actually used in the detection of gravity waves for the first time.
I don't think that's correct. I think I was maybe just a little bit too late for that, but I was certainly there at the time when all that was happening. I'd say at Caltech, actually. Caltech is an interesting place. But you know, for the right kind of student, it's definitely an incredible place to work. And there's always something interesting happening at Caltech, right? Like maybe not every department is like fully cooking at all times, but you know, a lot of the departments there are run by extremely competent and serious people who are really, you know, they're not wasting their time. And I was very fortunate again to kind of fall in with a group that you know, basically made up for my deficiencies and was interesting enough for me to keep working on for many, many years, which is a bit of a challenge for me personally. And yeah, we knew that LIGO was coming online and that these detections were going to occur. And actually the first ever detection occurred September 14, 2015, which was my last day at Caltech. Like that was the day I packed up my desk and left. And 5 years to the day after I arrived in California. So it's my American birthday, September 14. Yeah, and like, I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail, but my special little contribution to this piece was figuring out how to make the simulations, because we run simulations of these processes to do what's called match filtering. So we could essentially, once we detected a signal, figure out what it was that made that signal. And my contribution was making those simulations slightly less bad. And I think my work has been applied since in terms of that information or pipeline, if you like. But at the time, it really takes quite a lot of time to fully metabolize this kind of the new research occurring at the margins into, you know, essentially it was like this generic waveform library. And that fell to the grad students who came after me and had the misfortune of working on my work. But by all accounts, they did a great job and they really extended it. And so, yeah, I'm definitely a fan of applying rigor wherever you can.
So on the road to becoming a founder, you're now a tech founder of a very ambitious company. You spent some time at JPL, which I guess one could regard as maybe sort of partway between pure academia and more applied things. Could you just talk about that journey? Like what changed for you in terms of being more focused on a very purely scientific problem to something which is more applied?
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, by about 2011, probably 1 year into my PhD, I decided I didn't really want to be a professor or like maybe there were other more interesting things going on in LA, because I got to visit SpaceX back then and got interested in Tesla and a few other things. They're all kind of happening around me, which weren't happening to the same degree that they were in Australia, for example. And I've always been a space nut, but you know, Australia did not at the time have a space program. And even today, its space program is still very kind of embryonic. But so, you know, United States was the land of opportunity. And so, you know, working at JPL or working at NASA had always been something that I'd always desperately wanted to do, but it was not an option and is not an option unless you have a green card. So it took me 7 years after I arrived in the United States to finally get a green card and another 4 years after that to get my citizenship. Again, kind of shout out, like the immigration process, even for someone as highly qualified and from Australia and well-resourced as me, consumed effectively 20% of my working life.
Wow.
To get through.
Wow.
Which is absurd. It's a shame. And I know most of the news right now is about people crossing the border, without paperwork, you know, without permission, but having gone through the process officially myself, I cannot blame them in the slightest. And given the choice, if I was in their shoes, I would definitely not bother to wait around in some, you know, consulate or whatever in their country for like five lifetimes to get told no, like forget it. You only got one life. So where was I? JPL. Yeah. I mean, essentially JPL was always on the bucket list, and actually JPL's kind of funny because, like, yeah, they build robots that fly in space and go to other planets, and that's super cool, and that's part of what they do. They do a lot of other stuff as well, but I wouldn't necessarily say that they're particularly industry focused. Certainly, JPL is not run like a business. I'll put it that way.
So what what actually prompted you to start a company? Like, when did the idea first appear in your head that, yes, I could be a founder of a company, I could be a CEO?
Yeah, I think there is this kind of eager founders and slightly reluctant founders, and I put myself in the second group even now, and it's turned out way better than I had expected. Actually, the same goes for parenting. I thought the parenting would be much more painful than it has turned out to be, at least so far, knock on wood. It could always go worse, of course. But, you know, I guess starting in the early 2010s was thinking, well, like, to solve the climate problem, it's going to have to be a technological advance combined with a business model, right? Like, essentially, you have to, in order to essentially take off and propagate through the economy quickly enough, it has to be something that you're generating enormous value. And it seemed pretty clear to me that it had to be on the energy front, because we're just not going to stop digging stuff out of the ground for energy unless we have something better that's cheaper and easier. But I really had no vision for what that might be or how it could work. But then, you know, in that intervening period, and I was reasonably quick on the uptake there, solar started getting really cheap. And so I was like, well, if you could do something solar, solar and batteries. And I started looking into electric aircraft and stuff. Essentially, like, I like hard problems. But eventually I read some books about fracking and about the oil industry in general. And I ended up writing a book about industrializing Mars, which I guess I wrote mostly in 2018 or 2019. I can't even remember anymore. But, you know, essentially it had a chapter on different parts of the supply chain and part of it is hydrocarbons. You need oil and gas on Mars, to make plastics and things, make fuel. But as far as we know, there is no naturally occurring hydrocarbons on Mars, and it seems unlikely that there would be. So you're going to have to make it. And this has been recognized for decades, at least. And people have even built small scale demonstration plants to show how this can be done. And the kind of the aha moment was realizing that solar had gotten so cheap that you could power this system on Earth more cheaply than drilling holes in the ground to get oil and gas out. And I was like, wonder if anyone else has noticed this. And it turns out a few people had. So there's a startup in Santa Cruz called Prometheus, started by a guy called Robert Guinness, who's a serial entrepreneur now. He's done a couple other companies, and kind of based on a similar premise, had set out to go and make better gasoline. But, you know, essentially everyone has their own aesthetic and their own technological aesthetic. And I was like, well, you know, I wish this go well, but I think there might be an easy way of doing it. So I eventually realized that no one was going to do this for me, and got some support from friends of mine who put some money into what became Terraform Industries, and spent about a year in my garage, you know, simultaneously trying to figure out the technical problems with what became Terraform, and also at the same time, essentially self-immolating my JPL career. So in the end, it was an easy choice to make. And in retrospect, I should have done it a year earlier. Should have jumped earlier. What I would say to people out there is, like, obviously, if you have to be convinced to be a founder, you probably shouldn't be. It is a tough job. It's a job that really challenges and stretches you. But at the same time, if you're a technologist and you have a vision for the future that includes technology that does not otherwise exist, and no one else is going to build it, and in particular, most likely, it doesn't have a good business model behind it, but you can figure out how to do that, then if you don't build it, no one's going to build it. And, you know, it's too easy to be lying on your deathbed and be like, well, gee, I wish I'd done that.
Right.
But by then it's too late. So, and the other thing, you know, like, I think especially with these new AI tools and so on, it's not that hard to, like, cobble together some software prototype, you know, just proof of concept pretty quickly. But hardware takes time. Hardware takes time. And, you know, Elon Musk is a very controversial character, obviously, but it's important to realize that, like, both Tesla and SpaceX are get rich slowly schemes, right? Like both these companies just hemorrhaged money for like 10 or 15 years before they even began to threaten to turn a profit. And I think in retrospect, we can say that they had a charmed existence. You know, a lot of other companies have tried to do the same thing and haven't gone as well. So even with Tesla's example or SpaceX's example. So it does take a while. So it helps to start now. Start now. The best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago, and the second best time is right now.
I have so many questions. So I think the process that we're going to discuss, the actual process that Terraform is going to instantiate at scale, hopefully.
Yeah.
That had been considered already by other people as a possible process that people would parse.
Yeah.
Okay. And you became aware of it.
Yeah.
And
or even on Earth.
Or on Earth.
Yeah.
But I think when you first saw it, it was in the Mars context. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I first became aware of it in about 1996 in the context of
Mars. 1996.
But I mean,
yeah, a long time ago.
yeah, I mean, I read The Case of Mars by Robert Zubrin. He did a book tour in Australia back then. It was very formative. Thanks, Zubrin. But, you know, the chemistry that underlies this was developed in the 1920s and 1930s, you know, and very similar chemical processes have been adapted to massive scale. It's like ammonia synthesis, for example, is an absolutely colossal industry that drives fertilizers worldwide, and that uses pretty much exactly the same chemistry as what we're doing. So
right.
It's been done before.
So at what point have solar energy costs already decreased to the point where this is economically feasible? Are you forecasting where exactly are we?
Yes and yes. So it's important to remember that hydrocarbon cost and access is not uniform all around the world. Obviously, there's a Brent crude barrel of oil price, but the industry itself is easily 10,000 times more complicated than outsiders would guess at first blush. You know, most people's contact with this industry is that every week or so they fill their car up with $100 of fuel and they go, that was expensive. But they don't think about the fact that, you know, the same amount of money spent on food, even from a cheap fast food restaurant, buys, you know, 1% as much energy. Mm-hmm. You can feed your entire family for the same price, and the car consumes way more energy. And as long as the car runs, that's all they care about. But like, the process to get it there is every bit as exciting and weird and strange as like the process to make computers, make microchips, which is also like a deep lore. In some parts of the world, there are already places, probably hundreds of millions of people in terms of population, where the solar resource is good enough and solar costs are low enough and hydrocarbon prices are high enough that what we are doing would be in the money right now, even without any subsidies. On top of that, most of these places have subsidies for green or less polluting hydrocarbons. And then there are some places like parts of Texas or parts of Pennsylvania that have extremely cheap hydrocarbons. And that's probably going to be the case forever, or at least for the foreseeable future. But ultimately, I believe that solar will get so cheap that even there, we will be cheaper.
So in the places where you're in the money, do you have to make assumptions about the ultimate efficiency of your process to decide that you're already in the money now? I mean, how sensitive are you to...
You have to take that into account.
Yeah.
Yeah. So our process, we have a pretty good idea what our efficiency is because we can do math. I can tell you, your listeners may be interested, we're about 30 to 35% efficient end to end, which, I don't know, like if you know what we're doing, you're like, actually, that's pretty good. But if you're like, oh, wow, like 2/3 of your energy is going out the door as heat. But it's important to remember what we're doing is a thermodynamic conversion. And thermodynamics is notoriously merciless when it comes to making you pay to do certain things. So for example, converting heat into electricity is typically about 30% efficient as well. Your muscles, which convert chemical energy in the form of food into mechanical work that, you know, rides your bike or walks you around, are like 15% efficient on a good day. So that's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah. I think 30 is good. So 30% means that I think your
early steam engines were less than 0.5% efficient, for example.
Yeah. But okay. To take your specific example. And so for the listeners, so now we're starting to really talk about Terraform Industries. For the listeners, I just saw a great episode on YouTube of a channel called Nerds on Patrol, which was really quite charming.
Yes.
This, I don't know if they're a couple, but these two man and woman, visited Terraform.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Oh, not, they're not a couple. Yeah. Okay. So they visited Terraform, but they interviewed Casey, and then they interviewed a chemical engineer named, I think, Lucy, who's on your team.
Yeah.
And they do a much better job of exploring really all the details of the process than I could do on this podcast because they're there in the castle where Terraform.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes. So anybody who really wants to drill down on fascinating technology that's involved here, take a look at that. But just to clarify that 30% number. So if you have a kind of reference installation, which is, I think you said it was 500 acres of solar panels. With a
sure.
plant attached, the solar energy that's hitting that surface area of the earth, 30% of that solar energy ends up as methane, as natural gas at the end of your.
That's not quite right. The solar array itself is about 20-25% efficient. And then our process is, you know, about 30-35% efficient of the electricity that comes out. So
got it. Okay.
End to end, that's about 6%. Yeah. Which is, again, very good. So if you instead are growing plants to eat and then using that food to think deep thoughts or move stuff around with your muscles, compared to using that electricity directly with electric motor or running it into our system and then using the natural gas to create heat, make plastics or whatever. Because you make plastics out of plants as well. It's still about 100 times more productive. What we are doing is about 100 times more productive per unit area. Right. And that's not really a mystery because like we can do things chemically at like 900 Celsius and plants obviously can't do that. So like all of the chemistry that goes on in a plant has to be at roughly 30 degrees Celsius and in aqueous solution. And it's run by proteins that have to be produced from scratch. And the plant has to be self-reproducing and self-healing. And it spends an awful lot of its energy just staying alive of the energy it can capture from the sun. Photosynthesis itself is just not super efficient. It's really hard to yank oxygen atoms off a carbon dioxide molecule. And yet we use hydrogen and a catalyst in 400 degrees Celsius and high pressure, and plants don't have any of that. So it's just tough being a plant.
Well, so you're building an artificial plant here that is able to, I'm going to say this for the listeners, using solar energy, trap CO2 from the atmosphere, and as an output then, three different things. I'm going to say this quickly for the listeners. So trap CO2 from the atmosphere, extract hydrogen from water, and then react the hydrogen with the CO2 to make methane, which is natural gas. And so you're
yeah, that's how it works. I mean, the broad picture is it's a machine that makes cheap oil and gas from sunlight and air. That's it. So like all you really need to know about it is like right now, if you are burning gasoline, it's coming from an oil well somewhere. And instead, pretty soon it'll be coming from a solar array with our, pocket-sized chemical plant attached to it somewhere. It's basically just an oil well. From the outside, it's just an oil well, but it doesn't involve drilling holes in the ground. It doesn't involve new emissions of carbon from the atmosphere, emissions of carbon from the crust into the atmosphere. Yeah, and it operates, essentially independently off the grid. So you can put them anywhere you want, or anywhere where you have enough land, you can drop these guys down and start making fuel.
Yeah, and just emphasize this point, which is central to your original motivation, which is that it's not expelling carbon that it got from under the ground into the atmosphere. It's pulling the carbon out of the air. And so in a sense, if everybody was using your process for their natural gas, there would just be a recycling of the carbon into the atmosphere, back into the natural gas, into the atmosphere, back into the gas. And I think that was your, the climate change aspect was one of your main motivations, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, like it seems to me that it'll be extremely difficult for us to solve the climate heating problem unless we can find some way of building a fossil-free hydrocarbon supply chain. But that you probably want to build one anyway because the fossil fuels are fundamentally limited and 8 billion people on Earth need a good quality of life and there's not enough underground to give it to them. Even if it didn't cook the climate, it's still too expensive and environmentally damaging to go and get it out of the ground. So we need a post-fossil, post-drilling source needs to be built. Now's the time. This has fallen to my generation. My parents' generation knew about the climate change problem, but there's nothing that they could do about it. We can complain about, COP, conferences or whatever being ineffective or the Kyoto Protocol being ineffective. But at the end of the day, like either you're burning the oil or you're not. And if you're burning the oil and the oil comes from underground, you're putting CO2 in the atmosphere. And if you're not, then your life sucks. So like those are your choices.
Right.
Governments exist to serve their people, regardless whether they're democratic or not. There isn't a government on Earth that has successfully managed to starve its entire population of oil deliberately and remained in power and not had that process reversed. And there are a handful that have managed it through sheer incompetence, and the people in those countries live terrible lives. I'm thinking of North Korea here. So yeah, we actually, Terraform, our vision is we should increase the supply and decrease the price of hydrocarbons for humans forever. And incidentally, getting around the fossil problem.
Now, if I extrapolate the declining costs of solar energy and also the declining cost and increase in effectiveness of batteries, is there a future where actually the amount of natural gas that needs to be produced by your process is quite a bit lower than what you're expecting?
No. I mean, the use cases will evolve in the future as they have in the past. So, for example, we use a lot more natural gas making electricity now than we did 50 years ago. where we use mostly coal, and gas is a superior fuel compared to coal. But it's very strange to me that, like, you know, I guess we can make more of it, but like, assuming that it's fundamentally limited, we'd get this chemical out of the ground that we can make into anything. We can make it into medicines, we make it into plastics, pesticides, glues, you name it. And like three quarters of it, we just burn to drive cars around or burn to make electricity, when probably for 10 years now it's been a superior cycle, both on cost and efficiency and cost is the important one really, to directly get electricity from renewable sources, primarily solar, and then charge batteries. And so, you know, my expectation in 30 years is that, or even 20 years really, is that our grid will change its kind of operating modality. There'll be a lot more local generation of solar and maybe some wind and storage with batteries. So instead of having these big diurnal peaks of usage on the grid, it'll be pretty even. Much, much higher utilization of the grid, and then much lower utilization of those really expensive long distance grid assets. Mm-hmm. Like, they'll probably be deleted ultimately. Some people disagree with me on that, actually. So that's your disclaimer. And then we won't be burning much oil, coal, or gas to make electricity, because solar will be cheaper. So solar will be making most of the power. And then for transportation, people will be driving electric cars, trucks, other ground transport will ultimately go electric. However, shipping, maybe, eventually. Aviation, unlikely to go electric directly, not like battery powered. And rockets, obviously, and then the chemical industry as a whole, and then legacy heating of buildings and so on. Because for some reason, in most of the West, we've decided that we should drop the rate of city construction and reconstruction by about a factor of 10. We'll probably take at least a century to fully retrofit our existing building stock with heat pumps or whatever, so they can be electrically heated. And so they're going to continue to use gas for heating. And ultimately, we'll make other hydrocarbon products as well. So essentially, you name it, anything comes out of a refinery, we can make it cheaper, we can make it less polluting, and also we can make it locally. So if you're one of the, you know, N-1 countries on Earth that doesn't produce enough of its own refined oil products for its own use, which is essentially everywhere except the United States, when we're talking about countries of any size, you depend on the US Navy to keep the trade routes open so you can import oil from the Middle East or some other place. And we're kind of seeing the fragility of that system right now. And, you know, I don't have to tell your audience here, but like, we get calls almost every week from, you know, energy ministers and stuff, asking like, yo, can we talk about your process? Because it'd be amazing, you know, if we can locally produce our hydrocarbon needs, like not even to the country level, at the city level, really unwind a lot of the major problems associated with oil and gas logistics, both security and pollution wise. So, all these things are pulling in the right direction, which I think is super exciting.
I've heard you use the number 400 million of the sort of reference installation.
Yeah.
500 acres. That 400 million.
Well, so 400 million times 5 acres.
Well, 5 acres.
So 4,500 acres units, I guess, but yes.
And so where does that estimate come? That's in a future where the uses of the hydrocarbons are for those things you mentioned, like legacy heating and cooling and jet planes, maybe ships, but not all the other stuff.
Yeah, aviation in particular, I think, is poised for massive growth. So like kind of the history of the modernization of particularly American life over the last century has been that on average, humans have consumed about 100 times more energy now than they do back then. And that's brought us, you know, 3 times the life expectancy and a much better quality of life and much more wealth and opportunity. And at the same time, like most of the energy we were consuming back then was food, basically. Food for us, food for our animals. And a bit of wood or coal for heating, and that's pretty much it. And nowadays, of course, we use a lot of energy for heating and cooling and air conditioning, and increasingly for computation, and obviously transportation. But if you say, well, Steve, we're desperate here. We have to increase our per capita consumption of energy by another factor of 10. It's not clear how we do that, because like, we already have all the appliances. We already have the house that's heated and cooled. Like, what are the things that we do on a day-to-day basis that could easily consume 10 times more energy? And really, aviation is the major one there. Yeah. On a per capita basis. And then the other one is, well, what if we increase the capitas? Like, what if we increase the human population or population of sentient beings on the earth by another factor of 10 or 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000, principally by AI, like making, like, you know, a lot of AGIs running around in data centers, which could consume an awful lot of power as well. Mm. So in order to get the 400 million number, 400 million megawatts is 400 terawatts, which is about 20 times more electricity than the world currently produces and consumes. The way to get that is you take the current world population, And you assume that they each want to consume as much fuel as Americans do on average. And actually, even American consumption is strongly biased towards the wealthy members of society who fly planes a lot, for example. Most people on Earth do not fly planes very much at all, or at all ever. And then you basically multiply that out and you come to 400 terawatts. And it could easily be half that or twice that, in the final analysis. I kind of hope it isn't 10 times that, because very quickly you start to run out of land on Earth, to provide this fuel. And it turns out that our development cost will be probably on the order of a few tens of thousands of dollars per acre. But if you're developing current state of the art 1 gigawatt scale data center, your development cost is more like $250,000 an acre. Your development cost is about $2.5 million an acre. So like your land acquisition cost could be a tenth of that. It's $250,000 an acre. And like, it's very hard to imagine that land scarcity would become a major problem in terms of deploying more AI at that price. So I do wonder sometimes, like, are we going to, does it turn out that like the way AGI kills us is not, is not by like paperclip maximizing. It's by like us greedy capitalists, keeping on building more AIs to make more money until we've paved the entire Earth with solar panels. We'll have to see how that goes.
Yeah. I'm not sure which one's going to win.
I think there's room for both. Yeah. We'll get there sooner with the fuel, obviously, but land is fungible.
When you started the company, what did you think the major challenges were going to be?
Well, I'd read a few books about businesses and so on, but there's some good books out there. Yeah. Some minority of them. I have a blog post actually on various books I've read, but there's some good books out there on business. But the reality is that no one lives long enough to really gain a full perspective on what it takes to build and run a business. Even some serial entrepreneurs that's done 10 businesses successfully really doesn't have insight into what actually matters. It's all overdetermined, right? So I didn't really know what I was in for, and I knew that I didn't know, but I knew that I had to do it. So I just kind of plunged in, and if I ran into trouble, I'd give a friend a call or, read up on it, think about it, figure out what to do. What did I assume would be difficult? I was actually quite careful to make sure that none of the things we were doing required like a major miracle. In terms of things that I've, in retrospect, found to be quite difficult, I would say that some aspects of management did not come naturally and had to be learned. Fundraising is always more nerve-wracking than you think it should be, obviously. It'd be nice if that was not the case, but it just is. It turns out that it's a currency paid for in stress. On the technical side, we've had a few kind of false starts here and there. Nothing we weren't able to kind of correct course on pretty quickly. And if anything, I'd say now I'm much more confident on the tech than I thought I would be 2 years ago by now. So that's gone better, I guess, than I'd expected. But yeah, overall, I've been really lucky to have a great experience. I know not every founder does. And I also know that most startups go through multiple periods of near-death experiences. But if you just kind of keep on fighting, then you can at least make it through the acute failures. The kind of chronic problems of poor product market fit or whatever, or being crushed by competition or something more difficult to deal with. But I guess we'll take that, across those bridges when we come to it. I would say actually, I thought by now we'd have more competition. Yeah. Cause I mean, I've been pretty open about our technology stack. I've been put a lot of stuff on internet about what we're doing and how we're doing it.
I think it's a hard lift, which is why probably you don't have as much competition as, the logic behind it is, pretty sound, but to actually try to bite that off and get, engineer these systems.
Oh yeah.
Well, is tough, right?
No, it's a huge pain in the ass. That's for sure. And certainly if you're doing this in a conventional way, or if you had more experience in like a chemical engineering startup or something like that, you would definitely think what we're doing is impossible. And if you had less experience, you'd probably be like, I don't know enough to try. So you have to be a little bit crazy to try it, but also like the math doesn't lie. And I'm very lucky that I can do some sorts of calculations well enough with my physics background to know for sure that something will work. And so one of the things I like to say is that like, even if Terraform like ceased to exist tomorrow due to a catastrophic earthquake or something, the reality is that like the fundamental design that I've laid out, on the blog post has been demonstrated to work already. We've demonstrated it, but like it will work financially as well. So like drilling stays numbered. And really the question is like, can we be smart here and accelerate that process a bit and make money in the process? It's like, you know, it was never really in any doubt in Elon's mind, for example, that like electric cars would win sooner or later. The question is like, how much sooner can we make it if we try really hard? And so that's what we had to do.
So how far would you say you are from your first prototype installation?
That is a good question. Ultimately, the speed of execution at that scale is capital limited. So that's why we've been great and fortunate to work with some investors who've been able to, you know, basically keep our lights on and keep us working. And actually, in some ways, I think if someone had written me a $100 million check 2 years ago, we'd probably be worse off now because it's essentially impossible to make necessary engineering and organizational trade-off decisions without constraints. And economic constraints are great for that. But at the same time, you know, if this was a Manhattan Project and we had infinite money, I think we could probably move a little bit faster. But I would say at this point, I think we have a product-like prototype done by the end of the year. Whether we decide to burn toward that or not is still TBD. Because if it turns out that building a product-like prototype and we can put in the field and demonstrate by the end of this year is the most wise thing we can do with our resources for maximizing future growth, then yes, we'll obviously do it. But if it's not, then we won't. If there's some other things that we should do that will increase our odds of success in the short term, then increase the area under the curve of the probability of success integrated over, say, the next 10 years, then we will do that. And that's actually one of the more challenging decisions, because at the end of the day, that's a decision that I have to make and I have to live with. And there's no, even in retrospect, there's no way of knowing if you made the right decision.
Is this partly driven by what some potential investors want to see from you before they can commit? Is that driving some of these decisions over the next year?
So it's always very tempting as a startup founder to kind of dance to the tune of your perception of investor logic or investor preference. But thus far at Terraform, we have always done what we thought was right. And the investors who have joined us have been aligned on that front. I don't think you'll ever find us devoting major resources to stuff that's designed to look glitzy and glamorous to attract a certain kind of investor. And at the same time, I think there's enough sophisticated technology focused investors out there that they recognize that like we're not here to generate hype. And unfortunately, you know, part of the reason that I'm dead set on doing that is that there have been a number of companies, fairly prominent companies in the last, well, forever, basically, but like, let's say over optimized for investor attractiveness at the cost of their fundamental business. Mm-hmm. And it did not go well for them or for their investors. And so I think, you know, as I said, we only get one life. I want to use it on stuff that maximizes our probability of success. And to the extent that impressing the shit out of investors does that, then great. But to the extent that we're LARPing, you know, I don't know, like going way out of our way to, you know, satisfy some set of a criterion, which we probably don't even have very good insight into anyway, because none of us are investors, is I think a little bit silly. It's really important that we be brutally honest with ourselves and with the outside world. The stakes are too high to screw around.
So just so I can understand, like, for you to get from A to B, is it the case that, okay, there are a bunch of things you need to accomplish, say in an engineering sense, and you just have to try different things to see which one works? And so it's sort of iterative testing out.
At this point, it's mostly just iterative improvement of the underlying design. So like everything currently works. It just, in my view, it's a little bit too complicated and a little bit too expensive. It's actually pretty close. So like, one of the traps that I see hardware startups get into is they build their big demo, right? But they do it using processes that they know cannot scale. And so like at the end of the day, their engineering team spends a year or two or five getting really good at making the, you know, just the one time only demo work, but they don't actually spend any equity or any time like figuring out how it has to be solved at scale. And this is a mistake, right? Like the prototyping environment should be as close to the production environment as possible. And there's no shortcuts. So you just have to do it the hard way and learn and invest that time and effort in making your team know how to actually build stuff. And we've done that all the way along. So we're actually very, very close on that cost already, surprisingly so.
That's great.
I ran the numbers last week and I was like, that's actually pretty good.
Great. Is there an investor that you would love to meet with, but you haven't yet been able to get access to?
That's a good question. I would say actually like, everyone should write a blog. And having written a blog, a lot of my, not all my blogs, but some of them turned out to be quite good in hindsight. And I think word has got around. So I've been quite fortunate that the investment community, particularly in the West Coast of the United States, has really opened its arms to me, at least in terms of meetings and in person, which is the first step. And a good number of them have opened their wallets for us as well, which is nice. You know, it's one thing to think that like, oh, well, Casey probably has alpha when it comes to some obscure corner of industry that I'm not that interested in investing in, but I like talking to smart people or talking to people with contrarian ideas. And I can do that all day long. It's another thing to be like, and this is something that I'm going to deploy my investors' money behind. Obviously, it may be harder to justify. And there are certainly aspects of Terraform that are not necessarily very attractive to an investor. But yeah, I think I've been super fortunate on that front. It's actually a pretty cool, not without its flaws, obviously, but a pretty cool culture of trying to build new things and build good things. And I think especially now, I think maybe in some ways for the last 10 years, Silicon Valley kind of spun its wheels solving problems that weren't all that important, but they didn't really have a vision for what to do or how to apply themselves in a new way. And we're kind of seeing this hard tech or hardware tech renaissance right now, in part driven by energy just getting really cheap. We're going to get back on the Henry Adams curve and you know, really take that next step, that next 10x in energy consumption per person. And the logical endpoint of that is that we have, you know, multiple major airlines worldwide flying supersonic planes and fairly routine transport to low Earth orbit. And then we coexist with a lot of sentient AIs. That's going to be pretty rad. It might all happen in the next 10 years. And of course, our hydrocarbons will be synthetic, but that's our little contribution.
Those physical advances were the kinds of things in science fiction books, you know, that I read by Robert Heinlein when I was a kid. So it is a little surprising to me that it's taken so long for us to get there.
Well, it's much easier to write a book about it. I think that, again, people underestimate just how hard it is to make stuff. And for example, like in software, we have a pretty good stack right now. So with the exception of like the sort of nasty problems that I spent my PhD specializing in, but like for most consumer facing software, as I said, you can kind of cobble together a prototype pretty quickly. Which is some way of like, I think that's analogous to saying that like there's a fairly dense solution set to known problems in that space. Mm-hmm. And actually in many cases, you can solve that problem by spending money, which is the best kind of problem to have, right? Like, you know exactly how much it costs. You can just spend money. All the stuff we're doing here, we're building a bunch of hardware in house, is not stuff where you can just buy something off the shelf that does it, if only. But it turns out building this technology is really hard. And sure, we live in a world where we mass produce all kinds of stuff. You know, these headphones are mass produced, for example, but like almost every factory is designed specifically to produce one kind of thing in one kind of way. And it's not very versatile. And sure, if you're a manufacturing like technician or something, engineering designer, then you probably have a pretty good idea about how everything is made. You know, there's only like 30 or 40 standard processes that you can use and kind of cobble together by like Legos. But that's still a very, very long way from saying that like, oh, I have this idea from a Heinlein book and now I want to make it reality and make it pay for itself. Wow, we're not there yet. It's actually super exciting. I saw that Hadrian raised almost $120 million late last year, and they're doing kind of a prototype of a next generation factory. But again, like what they are doing is really they're machining certain kinds of metal in certain kinds of ways for a very certain slice of high margin, insensitive customers.
This is
not quite the same as having a...
This is CNC stuff?
Sorry?
They do CNC?
Yeah, it's mostly CNC. Yeah, CNC lathe mill. But like, that's a long way from being like, oh, I want a machine where I like prompt it with a, you know, print me a laptop and then out comes a laptop kind of situation. And again, people don't realize this because again, their contact with it is I go on Amazon and I click the button and pay the money and it shows up at my house a couple of days later. But you know, YouTube exists. You can always go and look at videos of how these factories work.
It's incredible. Yeah, incredibly. It's mind-boggling for me. I mean, actually, like when I watch those videos, I can only watch for a little while and then I have to pause because I have to digest what I've seen. Actually figure out, you know, how they're actually doing it.
Atoms don't want to do what you want them to do. They're very indifferent to your needs and desires.
Atoms are tougher than bits.
Yeah. I mean, they allow you to do different things than bits allow you to do as well. But it's just like the process required to take a rock out of the ground and turn it into something that people will pay money for is like... Yeah, it's tough.
So I'm sure investors ask you this question. As far as the defensibility of what you're doing, how much of it will be IP and patents that you filed and how much will be sort of just know-how or trade secrets?
As of now, we filed no patents. I was actually just thinking yesterday, maybe we finally invented something that's worth patenting. And I had a little browse around on Google, but I really do believe that like, this is a contrarian viewpoint, but like we're not the sort of business that would be defended by patents. What we're doing is not particularly defensible in general because strategic access to hydrocarbons is the sort of thing that governments nationalize in a heartbeat. So like, yeah, and China doesn't respect patents anyway. So like, what are your odds? Like really, if if someone came up and said, hey, we're going to infringe on your patents and copy your thing, I'd be like, how can I help?
Yeah.
Please, can I invest? I'd love it if you like in-housed some aspect of what we're doing here and we don't have to do quite as much stuff. Let's talk. No one's done that yet. I mean, we have LOIs with a number of companies that have like other reactors and things like that. And that's great. And we're very excited to help each other out. But at the end of the day, this kind of new air-based chemical platform really depends on getting super cheap electrolysis and super cheap DAC. And to the best of my knowledge, as of 1st of March, 2024, no one else is really approaching this problem in the way that I think is congruent with success. And that's why I started this company, because I surveyed 100 companies in this space. And I was like, well, they're all mostly run by well-meaning, smart people who are trying their best, but they haven't necessarily thought about this problem the right way. And I think I have. And of course, I may be deluded.
If you weren't trying to source the CO2 from the atmosphere, but you were just buying it from
an
industrial source, would that change your, would that make your process much cheaper?
No, for two reasons. Well, the moral reason is like industrially sourced CO2 is probably not carbon neutral.
Right.
And at the volumes required, but then the technical cost problem is that CO2 and hydrogen are both really hard to transport.
Mm-hmm.
And the transport adds a huge amount of cost to them. So much cost that you will never make money making fuel if you have to transport them, which is why the Terraformer is this modular system that sits inside the solar array. So we're not paying money transporting electricity and we're not paying money transporting hydrogen or CO2. The only thing we're paying money transporting is the product, methane, which we have an existing supply chain and product suite for transporting, and which is valuable so people want to transport it. But you say, well, why didn't you just use commercially available CO2? Well, there's not enough of it, and getting it to where you need it is too hard. And then like you say, well, okay, I've built a plant that uses commercially available CO2, and I've solved the supply chain in these handful of corner cases. But now again, you spent 3 years of your life optimizing around this corner case that won't extend, won't scale. This is our response to people who ask about carbon capture, which is usually construed to mean capturing carbon out of like coal plant smokestacks or something like that, which is like, okay, great. Now, if I want to build these things, I've got to go and find a place where I can put down a shitload of solar. And it also has to be next to a coal plant that also wants to talk to us and also won't be shut down in 5 years. Like, no thanks. I would rather, like, we are here to solve the general problem, and the general problem means no marginal constraints. Like, the only thing you need is land. And then, transporting the methane away from the site. There's a bunch of different ways of doing that, but that's a customer's problem at the end of the day. As it is today. I mean, like, essentially, where oil and gas occurs underground is not something that was particularly intentional when it came to when we sited our cities. So like figuring out how to transport that away from the site is something we've put as a species a lot of effort into. Hydrogen, just the cost of compressing and transporting hydrogen is more than the cost that we can afford to pay producing it.
Which is crazy. It just occurred to me that you should definitely try to speak with the sovereign wealth fund of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, because...
So actually, they've installed a lot of solar, and I'm actually super bullish on their use of desalination as well. So like one of my pet projects is trying to induce a major desalination project here in Southern California, like multi-gigawatt scale project. I think it would be, we'll have to do it sooner or later. We may as well do it sooner. But yeah, I mean, our door is open. If the Saudis want to talk to us, we're happy to clue them in. There's different kinds of investors. So it's important to remember that when you take money from someone, the best investor is one that gets out of your way, but not all investors see the world the same way you do. And some of them will ask you to do certain things that they may not otherwise want to do or think is a good idea to do. And again, we've been very fortunate thus far that our investors have been pretty well aligned. Once you start taking money from sovereign wealth funds, they start expecting you to show up at their events and building demonstration plants in their backyard. And that may not necessarily be the best deal for us, but it might be. Yeah. I wouldn't rule it out.
Casey, they
certainly have the money.
Something you said just triggered a memory of, I now remember how you came up in the conversation. I think before we started this interview, I was telling Casey that he had been recommended to me by some very smart people as somebody worth interviewing. And what had happened is I was talking to these guys who are all hardcore technologists about, as the price of solar gets low enough, we'll just start desalinating huge amounts of water. And then we were discussing that as something that's going to happen in the near future. And then someone said, oh, you got to talk to this guy, Casey. So that's how.
I wrote a couple of blogs on it. Well, I mean, so one of the consequences of climate change, which we're unlikely to be able to fix, is that certain river flows are going to get less reliable. Mm-hmm. And these river flows support billions of lives and tens of trillions of dollars of economic activity. And so when you look at that, you say, well, I know desalinated water is more expensive than water that falls from the sky for free. But what is the counterfactual? Like, what is the alternative to do nothing? Like, obviously, you could have a humanitarian catastrophe. But even if, like, let's say the Colorado's flows drop by a factor of two over the next 30 years, that's a major problem. Like, right? Colorado supports $1.4 trillion a year of annual activity. So you say, well, if I could spend $1 billion a year to solve that problem, would it be worth your while? Yes, obviously. Right? Like, not even close. Just in pure tax revenue, probably the Colorado River generates tens of billions of dollars a year. So obviously, like, it is worth your while to allocate some of that towards making sure that gravy train does not stop. And then you say, okay, well, how much would it cost to desalinate enough water to basically replicate the lower Colorado's extraction for Nevada, which takes almost nothing, actually, Arizona and California, which takes almost all of it. And the answer is probably like $1 billion a year for 10 years or 20 years to build out a very, very, very large desalination plant. And it has a bunch of other wider economic benefits. So like, you put a desalination plant down in the Imperial Valley or the Coachella Valley, and now you can solve the Salton Sea. So like this area of Southern California, which has a perfect climate and is otherwise uninhabitable because it's a festering environmental disaster and really a blight on Californians in general, you could just fix it. It becomes the world's largest swimming pool. Like you regulate its level and its salinity essentially by fiat as a side project here. You also make a shitload of light metals. You can recover a bunch of agricultural chemicals and reuse them. And at the same time, increase water flow to Mexico, which kind of got the raw end of the deal on the Colorado's water. And there's an area, you know, essentially right across the border in the Imperial Valley, which should be just as productive as the Imperial Valley, but is nowhere near as productive because they don't have enough water. They have salinity issues. And so you solve that problem as well. And like, well, why shouldn't we do this? It's going to cost half the cost of Twitter, like half the price that Elon paid for Twitter. We could solve water scarcity in California forever, unconditionally, even with today's technology. And you know, Arizona, similarly. That would require probably an act of Congress because it would require, you know, renegotiating aspects of these border treaties. But the amount of money involved is pocket change. It's like 1 year of NASA's budget. NASA does not spend a lot of money in the great scheme of things. And it would basically solve this problem forever. And then more generally, like you could do this. Yeah. You know, there's a bunch of rivers around the world. But essentially, you know, these rivers might be 1,000 miles long, but almost all the economic activity happens either very, very close to the ocean or very, very close to sea level, where the river kind of spreads out and there's alluvial areas where people can live. And that's so it's close enough to the ocean that you can just pipe water there from the ocean, you know, to pump it all the way up to the Himalaya or whatever. We should definitely do it.
And am I wrong in thinking that it would only take one or two orders of magnitude less money than that to get you to the finish line? So your company could get to the finish line for, you know, if someone put $1 billion into it?
Oh, we could productively spend $1 billion. So yeah, I mean, we're not planning on raising $1 billion anytime soon, to be clear. We're not quite that delusional, but you know, we're looking to raise some more money this year. And that I wouldn't rule it out, but I think it might be possible with our next fundraise to be able to get to profitability. And of course, after profitability, you continue to raise money, but it's a lot easier to raise money once you're profitable.
Yeah.
But you know, the question that I sometimes ask myself is, yeah, by say 2040, we'll be done. Hopefully early 2040s, you know, the world largely will be on synthetic hydrocarbon supply chain. We'll be no longer emitting crustal CO2. But right now the world is emitting something like, you know, 500 gigatons of CO2 per decade. Yeah. Not all of that ends up in the atmosphere. Some of it's absorbed straight away into plants and things, but it is quite a lot. And so if we're able to accelerate that date from say 2045 to 2035, then we probably save the world, you know, 0.4 degrees Celsius of temperature rise or something, mm-hmm. which will probably save, you know, at least tens of millions of lives from either death or really bad stuff from climate change. If you divide 10 million lives by 10 years, it works out to a few thousand lives per day. Mm-hmm. So like, I'm strongly motivated to find ways of solving this problem. There are other technical problems out there, for instance, that will solve many, many more lives than that. So for example, if we were able to halve the rate at which humans age, it would save 50 million lives a year, which is, you know, more than 100,000 lives per day. So like, that's obviously something that I hope smart people are thinking about. But as far as climate change goes, like we're just kicking ourselves in the shins at this point. There's no reason for us to go on getting carbon out of the crust, except that we, you know, terraform and society in general can't necessarily ramp our technology quickly enough. But everything we're doing here is about making sure that we can start building these factories that produce terraformers as quickly as possibly can. And there will come a day, probably later this decade, when actually our fundamental scaling constraint is not the rate that we can produce terraformers, it's the rate at which other factories can produce solar panels. And that'll be a very interesting time. This happened to Tesla, for example. So when Tesla started out, they were, you know, almost nothing in terms of global battery supply chain. But last time I checked, they're like 80% of 18650s used in Teslas. So they kind of outgrew that aspect of the supply chain, which is pretty epic.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So yeah, if someone wants to write us a $1 billion check, I'm pretty sure I can shave, you know, 4 or 5 years off that time frame. Yeah, that would be quite extraordinary. But I think realistically speaking, we've made amazing progress, and we still have there are still proof points that our team will need to bring forward to show that we're worthy of that level of capital allocation in a sane and rational world. Of course, investors in general are not necessarily rational, but we will see.
Well, I know at least a handful of billionaires and investors who listen to this show, so let's hope some of them.
Oh, great!
Hope some of them like the message.
Yeah. I'm very investable, I promise.
Great. Well, hey, Casey, this has been a great conversation. We're nearing the hour mark. What's the next thing people who follow Terraform should be on the lookout for? What are you going to announce? What's a hint of what you're going to announce in the next year?
What hint can I drop? I would say you don't have to wait for a year. Depending on how quickly SpaceX gets around to blowing up their next rocket, you might hear it this month. But yeah, so we've worked really hard over the last year, and we've hit a bunch of really critical milestones. And we're in the process of hitting a few more right now, and we're going to make a huge song and dance about it, because yeah, essentially, you know, there's kind of science risk and tech risk and financial risk, and we've retired a lot of that. I can't be more specific, unfortunately, right now, but yeah, my confidence right now that like we're not going to hit any more major technical hiccups or something is like 100%. We've basically cracked it. So this is, I'd say, like, if we were a rocket company, we'd be pretty close to the static fire. It's not quite the same as flying into space, but or making money while flying into space. But once you built the rocket and put it on the test stand and static fired it, you're like, well, we can make this thing work and all the pieces work and it doesn't explode. And that's actually further than 99% of rocket companies get. So I'm super proud of the team. They've really, I don't know, it's like you call it a miracle, but like you pull out a miracle every week, it doesn't feel like a miracle anymore. But they've really really shown their quality and shown their worthiness of this task over the last few months. I'm really impressed.
That's fantastic. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, and I wish you guys all the best. I will maybe check back in with you in a couple of years when you're using up all the solar panels on the planet.
Yeah, we'll have to fight with OpenAI for access to solar panels. No, it's super exciting because like right now the United States uses like tens of millions of acres to grow biofuels and other like basically poor uses of food. And we can rewild all that land and still have more fuel and cheaper fuel and better fuel and stuff that's better for the environment. So like, it's just a win-win-win. I just put out this blog post on environmental impact of terraformers. And like, I'm quite serious in saying like the solar chemical supply chain for humanity will enable humans, 10 billion humans, to live terrific lives alongside essentially a restored ecology for 90% of Earth's surface. And it's hard to imagine a better outcome than that, especially looking at where we were 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, where it looked like we were just going to cover everything in mall outlets and asphalt and extinctify every other species. Yeah, I think we're going to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat as far as human development goes here. We're going to pass the great filter. It's going to be awesome. Hang on. The crazy thing is like, we're already a decade into this. Like solar has already been critically cheap for a decade and it's been kind of growing in the background. But you know, last year, for example, the United States deployed more solar than it has ever built nuclear, for example. And that's the same at the global scale as well. And the capacity factor is a little bit different, but solar is astonishingly cheap, astonishingly more productive economically and energetically than agriculture. It's really like agricultural revolution 2.0. It's happening.
It's funny because just a few years ago, the great stagnation thesis was pretty popular, but now it looks like with AGI and energy innovations like yours, it might become apparent soon that there's no great stagnation.
No, we're going to solve a bunch of problems. I have a blog post called "You Should Be Working on Hardware" that has like basically a bucket list of problems that I'd be working on if I had infinite time. And I'm quite confident that we're going to solve at least half of those in the next 20 years. And that'll be a radically more exciting future. And I think more people need to talk this up, because yeah, I think tech's really, really got kicked around for the last decade, and yeah, tech made a few mistakes. But at the end of the day, like the thing that separates our lifestyle from that of the Paleolithic people who were hunted by saber-toothed tigers and other hominid species and lived short, desperate lives plagued by child mortality and just other horrors that are beyond comprehension for most of us today is technology. And yet we can build it and we can use it. We should accelerate it. I mean, the crazy thing to me right now is the single biggest break in the United States that's preventing the deployment of solar power, which saves about 100 lives per gigawatt per year in terms of avoided pollution from legacy coal plants that are being displaced, is the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. The Environmental Protection Act is slowing down these deployments, which are going to occur anyway, sooner or later, by years. And it's killing thousands of people every year.
Wow, what?
Like more than a 9/11 of people are killed every year from avoidable air pollution.
What?
Caused by the United States slow rolling deployment of solar power because of restrictions that have been, they're not even in the text of the Environmental Protection Act. They've kind of been added by regulation since that slow all this shit down. It's absolutely infuriating. But we will ultimately prevail. We will break through and we will deploy enough solar to give every man, woman, and child on Earth the lifestyle they deserve, despite the best attempts of, I think, people making an honest attempt to enforce regulations that have passed the use-by date.
Great. Well, that looks like a good place to end it. Casey, I thank you again for being on the show.
You're most welcome. It's been a pleasure.